As a young boy, I grew up, as I've mentioned before, on Eastern Long Island, and it was a regular occurrence for us as a family during the summertime to take at least two trips to the South Shore, what you all know as the Hamptons, which weren't the Hamptons in the 60s. It was just East Hampton and West Hampton and Southampton. It was no big deal. But it's where the ocean was. And so we would spend a couple of days over there playing on the beaches, swimming in the ocean, enjoying a day outside in the summer. One of the activities that we did when we were young and at the ocean was, and you've probably seen these as well, build sandcastles. Now, it helped if the sand was a little bit damp. So you tended to build those closer to where the tide came in because the sand was a little bit damp and you could get a pretty good size sandcastle. But there was a problem with that. Once the tide came in, the sandcastle was washed away.
Even castles in the sand fall in the sea.
Eventually. That's right. They get washed away. As I thought about that this week, I thought about also making a confession. There are times when my faith is like that sandcastle. It's bright and full and strong until a big wave of life washes over it. And then I find that my faith is not quite as vibrant as it once was. There are times for all of us when life can be hard, when prayers seem to go unanswered, when people seem to be less helpful and more hindering than we would like, and change doesn't seem to come in our own lives or anyone else's. When you find yourself in those kinds of situations, let me suggest you go to Joshua 6. Because Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 30 reminds us that by faith, the walls of Jericho fell after they'd been encircled for 7 days. And what we will discover this morning is that the faith of the nation of Israel is based on God's promise, God's character, and God's past provision. For when we know who God is in His promise and His character and His provision, then our faith is safe and secure. The context, just to fill us all back in, since it's been a week and we've probably have forgotten some of this, the people have identified themselves with God through the covenant of circumcision. They've set up the memorial stones to be sure they don't forget the miracles that God has performed for them in crossing the Jordan River. They've been reminded that God is with Joshua just as he'd been with Moses. And now it's time for battle. Will they continue to live by faith, or will the obstacles cause them to waver? Will the size of the city and the enemies that are there wash over them in such a way that their faith wavers, or will they remain strong in faith and win the battle? Here's the brief outline for this morning. It actually starts in chapter 5. We'll start in chapter 5, verse 13, through chapter 6 and verse 7. That's the plan or the strategy for victory. Then we pick up in verse 8 of chapter 6. That's the path or the sequence to victory. And then we get to the end of the chapter, verses 22 to 27, and that's the promise fulfilled or the sequel to victory. I love that outline because it's not my own. I stole that from somebody else, but it seems to fit, and so I'm sharing that with you. The plan or the strategy for victory begins in Joshua chapter 5 and verse 13. When Rocky concluded the lesson last week, and I wasn't here because I was doing elder duty, I've been told that the nation of Israel had just completed the Passover. The manna has ceased to be provided. They are entering the promised land, have entered the promised land, and now they are eating the first fruits of the land to which they have entered. And to order for them to continue To possess the land, the enemy had to be driven out. And the first city that they encounter in the promised land is Jericho. And we find Joshua standing, sitting, walking, it doesn't say, but it says he was by Jericho. Doesn't say what he was doing, just says he was by Jericho. And he lifted up his eyes and he saw something. Now, I would like to suggest to you, and this is a suggestion, it's not in the text, it's just a thought process, that Joshua was looking at the city of Jericho and trying to figure out what a good battle strategy would be. I mean, he was the commander in chief. It was his responsibility to lead the nation. At this particular moment, the activity of how that city was going to be defeated has not been revealed. See, part of the problem is we know the story, and we tend to read back into the story, but it's all new for Joshua. So he, despite his military training, had never led an attack against a fortified city. The only weapons that they had were spears and slings and arrows. There were no battering rams. There were no catapults that they would have to knock down the walls and defeat the city. So Joshua, as the commander-in-chief, is standing by the city of Jericho thinking about how in the world they're going to defeat this city. And while Joshua is contemplating that, he becomes aware of a man with a drawn sword standing in front of him. Now, I don't know about you, but I know about me, if I'm standing there and all of a sudden there's a man with a drawn sword, I'm going to back up. But it doesn't seem to startle Joshua. Doesn't even really seem to surprise him. Because what Joshua did is simply ask him a question. Are you for us? Or are you for our adversaries? You know, are you for us or against us? Here's a man with a drawn sword. The response of this individual is no. Wait a minute. Maybe a better translation would be neither. And the man identifies himself, the individual. He says, rather, I indeed come now as captain of the host of the Lord. He's captain of the host of Yahweh. And Rocky may have mentioned this, but if not, I will. And if he has, it's repetitive, and that's always a good learning tool anyway. Host is a Hebrew term, a military term that speaks of army. So this individual, this person with the drawn sword, what we might call a warrior, is the one who has sovereign authority over the army of heaven. That's how he identifies himself. I am the captain. I'm the one who's in charge of the armies of heaven. Many commentators call this the divine warrior. That's a good title. Doesn't take a seminary education for Joshua to realize who this person is. Because notice his response. He fell on his face, he bowed down, and he said, what has my Lord to say to his servant? Joshua worshiped and submitted the authority of this individual. He bowed down in worship, and he says, what do you have to say? I.e., what do you want me to do? The captain of the Lord of hosts says, Joshua, remove your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy. That's almost a verbatim statement from Exodus chapter 3 when Moses was at the burning bush, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Moses, remove your sandals. The place you are standing is holy ground. That verbatim, just a second. That verbatim statement suggests strongly that this individual here in Joshua chapter 5 is the same individual that showed up to Moses in Exodus chapter 3. Now, how did the individual in Exodus chapter 3 identify himself when Moses said, "Who are you?" "I am. I am that I am," which we know is the Lord Almighty. Moses was privileged to have a visitation from God in what we would call a theophany, a pre-incarnate Christ. And I'm convinced that Joshua is getting the same vision here. He's getting a glimpse of the pre-incarnate Christ. Because the issue is not whose side the warrior is on. The issue is whose side is Joshua on. Because the warrior simply says, "This is who I am." We know whose side Joshua is on because he submits to the authority of the warrior. What do you have for me to do? Mike.
Angels habitually reject worship, so I think you can rule out the likelihood that he was an angel.
Absolutely, yeah. Because he
took him at his word.
It took him for who he was, exactly. And I think you're again getting an indication of the faith that Joshua had, but you're also getting an indication that his faith exhibited itself in action, in worship and submission.
That's James.
Wow. Yeah.
The Spirit keeps our body alive, and our faith, our works keep our faith alive.
Because faith always.
Not salvation, but
yep. And I'm convinced that when our faith begins to wane, we need to follow the model that Joshua has for us, and we submit to God's authority, we recognize who he is, we worship him, and then we say, "What do you want me to do?"
Amen.
And when we respond that way, our faith grows, just like Joshua's did. His faith was assured of the presence of God in the midst of something completely new. It wasn't that Joshua hadn't been involved in military conflict. He had. But he had never led a military army against a fortified city like Jericho. Having assured himself of God's presence, and having been assured by God of God's presence, God gives to Joshua the battle plan in verse 2 of chapter 6. The Lord said to Joshua, "See, I've given Jericho into your hand with its king and the valiant warriors. And you're going to march around the city, all the men of war circling the city once. You shall do so for 6 days. And 7 priests shall carry 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. And then on the 7th day, you shall march around the city 7 times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. It shall be that when they make a loud blast with the ram's horn, and when you hear the sound of the trumpet, and all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city will fall down flat, and the people will go up every day straight ahead." Now you may have noticed and went, "Wait a minute, what happened to verse 1? If you were to take the text and start in chapter 5 and verse 13 and eliminate verse 1, it flows really well. Because Joshua had said to the captain, what do you have to say to me? What do you say? The captain said, "Remove your sandals from your feet. The place you are standing is holy." Joshua did so. And the Lord said to Joshua, "I've given you the land. I've given Jericho into your hand." Doesn't that flow? Doesn't that make perfect sense? So what in the world do we do with verse 1? Jericho was tightly shut because of the sons of Israel, and no one went out and no one came in. It almost seems like an interruption. Matter of fact, it is an interruption. It's a grammatical interruption. It's a stylistic interruption. Because all the other statements prior to verse 1 and succeeding verse 1 concern Joshua and the Lord's words to him. So this stylistic, grammatical intrusion, for lack of a better word, of verse 1 presents an obstacle that I would like to suggest from a grammatical perspective is a means to remind the reader and us that just like the Jordan River was an obstacle that needed to be overcome, so Jericho as a walled city is an obstacle that needs to be overcome. And apart from the work of the Lord in the life of Joshua and the people, the obstacle will not be overcome. And so he just puts it there. The writer puts this verse 1 right there. Ralph.
I'm sorry. Could we go back to the drawing board?
Mm-hmm.
We look at that, the pre-incarnate Christ, cool.
Yeah, got it.
For the monotheistic Jews, who didn't have a concept of the Trinity yet, the divine warrior doesn't identify himself as I am who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't say I am the captain of my own army. Which seems to me there's a separation between him and Yahweh, which is no problem for us. How did the monotheistic Jews, all through, you know, the time of Ezra and so forth, how did they deal with that to where it's not an angel, because angels reject the worship, but he seems to separate himself from Yahweh?
There's obviously an indication that Joshua knows it's Yahweh in some vision form. Not necessarily a Trinity. Not, again, going back, then I can say it's the Holy Spirit. But you can go back to Genesis in the beginning writings, let us make man in our image. And there's an indication that there's a unity in the mix, I mean, a diversity in the midst of the unity, because it's an us, it's a plural noun, as God identifies himself.
Is that not just compound? Would they not just see that as the war of the we?
Perhaps. I mean, I can't tell you exactly how they would see it, you know, from that perspective. Rocky may have a little more insight.
I did a lesson on evidence for the Trinity in the Old Testament that is under the topical category on the website. Mm-hmm. And I'm not suggesting that they had a full understanding of the Trinity, but there's a lot more to indicate that there was some understanding of it than we might think.
Okay.
When you get to the New Testament and you start thinking about the intertestamental period, that 400-year period, you see that the Trinity was assumed. So I would suggest if you have the time, go back and look under topical.
Okay.
The title is Evidence for the Trinity in the Old Testament, and I think it'll answer a lot of those questions.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for that reminder. I'd forgotten that. So... So the writer reminds us that the walls of Jericho were tightly shut, which really shouldn't surprise us, should it? Because what do we already know about how the people who were in Jericho viewed the nation of Israel? They were terrified. So what do people do when they're terrified? Lock the doors. Get security systems. Get the alarm set up. Put bars on the windows. Shut yourself in because it's safe in here. What else would they do? It's very understandable why the Canaanites, the folks in Jericho, had shut themselves in, hoping to survive. So the Lord says to Joshua, here's how you're going to defeat the city. Now remember, Joshua was the military leader. Joshua had led the nation in military conflict. So God says to Joshua, this victory will be won with a parade. That's in essence what it is.
Beforehand.
Yeah. He reminds him in verse 2, I've already given it to you. It's my gift to you. And it's already been accomplished. It's that... prophetic perfect in the Hebrew language that says, I've already done it. It's an accomplished fact. And he mentions the city, the king, and the warriors. So it's not just some nebulous, okay, you're going to win the victory over the city. I mean, I've already given you the king, I've already given you the city, and I've already given you the valiant warriors. Done deal. It's my gift. Victory is assured because God has made a promise. But here's how you're going to realize the victory. you're going to have a parade. And the parade is going to include trumpets. It's going to include warriors. It's going to include the Ark of the Covenant. It's going to include priests. And it's going to include marching. And you're just going to watch this whole thing happen. And it's going to happen in a period of time. You know, there's going to be 6 days where you're going to march once, and on the seventh day you're going to march seven times, and on the seventh time you're going to blow the horns, people are going to shout, the walls are going to fall. I mean, we read this story as if it's no big deal because we know the story. But you have to put yourself into the sandals of Joshua and the people of Israel, who knew by experience that military victories don't happen because you march. Military victories happen because you engage in battle. Because you get the bows and arrows out. Because you get the spears out. Because you put on the armor. That's how military victories are won. So how much faith is it going to take for Joshua and the priests and the soldiers and the people to actually follow through and do what God commands?
It's the same for us.
It's no wonder that the writer to the Hebrews says, by faith the walls of Jericho fell.
We're called to go out into a world that hates Christ and proclaim it.
And it goes back to a statement that was made that we talked about just a few minutes ago. Because faith works. Faith believes what God says and acts on it. Otherwise, it's just an intellectual assent.
No, I'm not saying that.
No, I am. Because faith believes what God says and acts on it. Joshua heard what God said, and then he organized the people. That demonstrated his faith. Faith believed and acted. Because faith demonstrates its confidence in God.
Man steps out in faith.
Sure. Yeah. He acts on the faith that God has.
Faith that produces faith.
Yes, it does. So we encounter day one in verse 8 of Joshua 6. Let me go back just a little bit. Joshua, the son of Nun, called the priests, and he said to them, take up the Ark of the Covenant. Let seven priests carry seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of the Lord. Then he said to the people, go forward, march around the city, and let the armed men go on before the Ark of the Lord. And so it was. When Joshua had spoken to the people, the seven priests, carrying the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Lord, went forward and blew the trumpets. And the Ark of the Covenant followed them. The armed men went before the priests who blew the trumpets, and the rear guard came after the Ark while they continued to blow the trumpets. But Joshua commanded the people, saying, you shall not shout, nor let your voice be heard, nor let a word proceed out of your mouth until I tell you, shout. Then you shall shout. So we had the Ark of the Lord taken around the city, circling it once. Then they came into the camp, and they spent the night in the camp. That's day one. Jericho was not a large city. Archaeological excavations have revealed that it might have been about 8.5 acres. That might make it a little bit more than 1/4 mile on each side. I still remember what Charlie Dyer said to us when we were about ready to get off the bus and view the ruins of Jericho. And his quote was, be prepared to be underwhelmed. There's really not that much there.
Big pile of dirt.
And it's not that big. There's not a whole lot to see amongst the ruins of Jericho. But Joshua says to the nation, here's what's going to happen. And this is what they do on day one. And then they're done. And they just sit there. It appears that Joshua does not give to the priests or the soldiers or the people the whole story. He just gives them day one. And here's what you're going to do. You're going to, here's the ark, and here's the priest, and here's the horns, and here's the warriors, and here's how you're going to do this. Here's the march that's going to take place. But you don't say a word. No conversations among yourselves. No screaming and hollering at the walls. No picking up rocks and throwing them. March in silence. And come home. Now, you need to also know, it's not the whole nation marching around the city. It's just some priests and some warriors. Not all of them. Matter of fact, it's very possible that the size of the group marching around the city would have encircled the city. That is, by the time the first person finished marching around, the last person was starting. Because again, it wasn't that large a city. So the rest of the nation is just standing on the sidelines watching this whole process. At the center of all of this is the Ark of the Covenant. Again, the reminder of God's presence. Because the Ark is mentioned 11 times in verses 4 through 13. You know, when God repeats himself, there's a reason for that. It was God's presence that encircled Jericho. It was God's presence that would ultimately bring it to fall. Because central to Israel's experience of faith was the reality that God was present with them. And he was there represented by the ark and heralded by the trumpets. As God was with them in the midst of the battle, so God is always with us. Matter of fact, I have a theory. And so I'll throw this out to you and you can process this. The more we are aware of God's presence with us each and every moment of every day, the more we are aware that life is sacred and that every moment is sacred. Not sacred in the sense that, oh, wow, but sacred in the sense that what I do matters. Sacred in the sense that I worship God wherever I am. Sacred in the sense that the ministry has an effect because God is present. The place I'm standing is holy ground because God is present. The more we're aware of that, that God is always present with us, not just as a theory, but as reality, in the person of the Holy Spirit, God is with us, the more each act of life becomes sacred. Just a theory. You work on that and process that. Always. Day two. Joshua rose early in the morning, verse 12. The priests took up the ark of the Lord. The seven priests, carrying the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark of the Lord, went on continually. They blew the trumpets. The armed men went before them. The rear guard came after the ark, and they continued to blow the trumpets. Thus the second day, they marched around the city and returned to the camp. End of day two. Summary, they did this for 6 days.
It sounds like they might not have had the city surrounded. Why didn't the people in the city run away if they were so scared?
Because what do people do when they're fearful? I still think people in general just huddle. They bar their doors in their homes today. Uh-huh. They don't run away. They try to make themselves more secure within their places that they know than to go to someplace they don't know.
And the walled city is the safest place that they've ever
thought. No, it's a walled city. What's going to happen? How they can look out and see the nation. They can see the battlements that the Israelites may have. They know that the waters have been parted. They know that God is mighty. But knowledge doesn't always translate into positive action. So they just wall themselves in for their own protection.
It's because God determined it to be. He raises up vessels of wrath that turn for destruction. He's going to show his power.
Yeah, he is going to show his power. Oh. As day two dawns, Joshua arises early, it says. organizes the priests in the ark. Second verse, same as the first, as they say. Third verse, same as the first. Fourth verse, fifth verse, sixth verse. And again, it appears that Joshua did not unfold the entirety of the plan to either the priests or the warriors or the people. He said, here's day one. Here's what you're going to do. Day two, do it again. Day three, do it again. Day four, do it again. And after every day, the walls are still standing. Jericho hasn't surrendered. And so what's required? Faith. Do you really believe that this is going to be effective? That God's going to do what he says he's going to do? Are you going to trust him in the midst of seeing nothing change? But we haven't gotten to day seven yet. We probably should make a couple of comments about the number seven, because it figures prominently in the chapter. You know, there are seven priests and there are seven trumpets and they're marching around the city for 7 days. And on the seventh day, they're making seven trips. I had a friend of mine in Pennsylvania who thought every number allegorized to some spiritual principle. Good friend. Love him to death. Still a good friend. But I used to say, Paul, sometimes a number is just a number. Number two is number two. It just took 2 days. That's all it means. So in this case, I do think seven means a little bit more than just the number seven, because of how often it's repeated. It corresponds, among other things, to the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which took place during this season that God had set forth for the nation of Israel to witness the defeat of the Egyptian army. During this 7 day period, 40 years later, they're going to see the defeat of Jericho and the possession of the land that God had promised. The battle, if you can call it that, becomes part of the Passover celebration. The primary purpose of the Passover celebration initially in the nation of Israel was to remind them of God's deliverance of the nation of Israel out of Egypt. It's a reminder. Here, set this up. Take this lamb, sprinkle this blood. Because if the blood is there, God will pass over and you will be safe. I will protect you. The Passover is a reminder of God's deliverance. So here they are about to march around the city, and will God deliver them from the enemy that's in the nation of Canaan? Will they defeat Jericho? Mike.
Okay, for Pharisees looking back, it's okay to march on the Sabbath, but it's not okay to do it on the Sabbath.
Sure. They can gather a lot of things, because all of that stuff, the rules and regulations about the Sabbath, were very much added well after the fact, you know, in terms of how that's to be lived out for the nation of Israel. So they're marching. Again, you have the whole point of the shofar and the trumpet. The first time you read about the ram's horns is on Mount Sinai, when the Lord announced his descent upon the mount where he would impart the word. Exodus chapter 19 and verse 16. The shofar becomes part of the worship of the nation. It called the people to worship. Leviticus chapter 23, Psalm chapter 98. You can find illustrations of the shofar calling the nation to worship. In fact, again, I had another friend in Pennsylvania who was a musician, and he actually purchased a ram's horn, a shofar, and we used to blow that on Easter Sunday morning as a call to gather. We'd stand on the porch outside in the front of the church, and we'd blow the shofar so it would go out into the neighborhood. We're calling you to worship the resurrected Savior. It was just because it's just a sample, an illustration of what the shofar became for the nation of Israel. Now, we're going to come back to the shofar in just a few minutes, so hold on to that thought. The seventh day arrives. Joshua gives a different set of procedures for the last day. The seventh day, they rose early. So they're getting up early every day. At the dawning of the day, don't you love the specifics? The sun rises, you get up. They marched around the city in the same manner 7 times. Only on that day, they marched around the city 7 times. And at the 7th time, when the priests blew the trumpets, Joshua said to the people, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the city. The city shall be under the ban, and all that is in it belongs to the Lord. Only Rahab and the harlot and all who are with her in the house shall live, because she hid the messengers whom we sent. But as for you, only keep yourselves from the things under the ban, so that you do not covet them, and take some of the things under the ban, and make the camp of Israel accursed, and bring trouble on it. But all the silver and the gold and the articles of bronze and iron are holy to the Lord. They shall go into the treasury of the Lord." We need to talk about the ban for a minute. The Hebrew word harem. It involves the devotion of something to the Lord. That's what the word, it means that this is given specifically to God. It's for His exclusive use. Jericho was God's. It was for His exclusive use. And He was going to use it to demonstrate His power, His judgment, and His promise. It was going to have a different effect on those in the city than it was going to have on the Israelites outside of the city. But it belonged to God. It was for His exclusive use. In Deuteronomy chapter 20, we're told that the reason the things in the city are destroyed, the detestable things, is so that the nation of Israel will not be tempted to hold on to them and worship the gods of the Canaanites. It's interesting, we come up against this when we get to Ai and Achan, who covets some of those things that belong to God. They were told not to take them. Joshua places all of Jericho under the ban. For the living creatures, that means death. For the valuable possessions, the gold, the silver, the bronze, and the iron, it means they go into the house of worship, the house of God. For everything else, it's destruction, either by falling or by fire. Nothing escaped that had been dedicated except Rahab and her family. I'm convinced the text is saying that so that we're reminded that the salvation of Rahab and her family was as important as the destruction of Jericho. Ralph.
Verse 17, because she hid the messengers whom he sent. Why do they use the word messengers?
Good question. That's what teachers say when we don't know the answer. Perhaps just simply to say, we sent a messenger, a individual, who came back with a message. We could have called them spies. We could have called them messengers. We could have called them individuals. I mean,
emissaries.
And I wouldn't make a big deal out of that specific word, personally, but that's just my perspective at that point. These are the folks that she hid. You know who I'm talking about, says Joshua to the nation. They would know.
That coupled with that, he raises up vessels of wrath prepared for destruction. He raises up vessels of mercy.
Yeah. And she's one of them.
That's right.
That's Rahab. And we went over that when we were in chapter 2. And her connection, her statement about who God is and therefore her commitment. I've heard about what God has done. I know that your God is mighty and there is no other. And I'm trusting in Him. Now, she didn't say specific words, "I'm trusting," but it's obvious that she did because she hid the spies. Her faith demonstrated itself in what she did for the spies. She acted in faith. John?
Yeah, what was the span of time between the visit to Rahab by the spies and then now?
Relatively short.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'd have to go back and look specifically, because they sent him over. They were still on the other side of the Jordan. And they remained there for, I know it says, I just don't remember, a period of time, a week or two before the waters crossed, because they were looking at the waters, and then they crossed, then they came over, and now they're marching for a week. So short time, I would say less than a month, without going back and looking at the specific dates that are recorded in the book of Joshua. So the nation of Israel, Rahab's salvation is as important as the destruction of Jericho. With all of that information from the practice of the first 6 days, the nation is assembled, and on the seventh day, they're marching seven times and blowing the trumpets, and then the nation, Joshua says to the folks, shout. This was not a woohoo. You know, when they shouted, they shouted. The parade of Israelites, the warriors put their whole voice into the shout, and the text tells us that the walls fell flat. You know what the literal translation of that word is? Prostrated themselves. Same word we would use of someone falling flat on their face to worship. The walls fell flat, and every man went straight ahead into the city.
Archaeological note, they fell out.
Yeah. Yeah. Out, flat, down. So, yeah, because rock not, falling down, not, have to go
like,
somewhere.
Not like they would have been battered in by war engines.
Yes, correct. And then the text says every man went straight ahead into the city, which means there weren't just a few holes in the wall. All the walls fell, except where Rahab's house was. Now, there are some scholars who want to tell us it was an earthquake. That would be pretty coincidental, don't you think, to have an earthquake happen at the exact same time on the seventh day, on the seventh time, as the nation shouted and the horns blew, that an earthquake happened. Now, this was a miraculous event in which God demonstrated his power and his promise. The horns blew. People shouted, the walls fell. One more time.
Any indication of how tall they were?
The original height?
Yeah.
No, I do not know that.
Okay. I just wondered, it would seem like the defensive soldiers would have been on the wall and would have been at least injured.
Injured, yeah.
If you want to look at Kathleen Kenyon's work, the archaeologist who's primarily worked Jericho, yeah. Kathleen Kenyon.
Returning just to the shofar, the ram's horn, for a minute, just because it's an interesting process to recognize where in the New Testament you find that. The Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout, the voice of the archangel, and the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first, and those who are alive and remain will be caught up together with the Lord in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and thus we shall always be with the Lord. What does the rapture signify for the believer? We're blessing. We're in the presence of the Lord forever. What's the rapture signify for the non-believer? Judgment, destruction, loss. Same thing happens in Jericho. When the horns blew and the people shouted, for those inside the city, it was the end. It was destruction. For the nation of Israel, it was a demonstration of God's provision and blessing. The promise is fulfilled, or the sequel to victory is found in verses 22 to 27. Joshua said to the two men who had spied out the land, go into the harlot's house, bring the woman and all she has out of there as you have sworn to her. By the way, here's a little side note. Do you notice that every time Rahab's name is mentioned, she's called the harlot?
Like Simon the leper?
Yeah, Simon the leper. I mean, it's like, even though she's identified herself as an Israelite, as a believer, if you will, in our terminology, she still has this moniker hanging over her. Oh, it's Rahab. Oh, you know what she was like.
A vessel of mercy.
Yeah, a vessel of mercy. She was the harlot. So the young men who were spies, and now they're called spies. Ralph, here's you go back to your verse 23. The spies went in. They brought out Rahab with her father and her mother and her brothers and all she had. And they brought out all her relatives and placed them outside the camp of Israel. Stop for a minute and just think. Suppose you had been Rahab while these 7 days are taking place. You know, hang the cord in the window. Yeah, scarlet cord.
She'd make sure the knot was tight.
Wouldn't she? Do you think that she went and looked out that window and went, "Hey, remember me?"
Put a couple more in there.
Did you think she looked out and thought, "Do I remember? Can I see well enough to see the spies that I hid?" You know, I think that there was a great amount of not just faith, but obviously faith, but also just, is it really going to happen? Is it really going to be safe? It had to be the longest week of her life. But again, she also acted in faith. Rahab is, the promise to Rahab is fulfilled because she's brought out. She becomes part of the nation of Israel. Rahab and the harlot and her father's household and all she had, Joshua spared. And she lived in the midst of Israel to this day. For she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent. She had become part of the nation of Israel. She had identified herself as a believer in Yahweh. And she worshiped him and became part of the nation. Again, the promise that God made through the Abrahamic covenant that the nation of Israel would be a blessing to the other nations, you see exemplified and fulfilled in illustrative form in the life of Rahab and her family. There's the promise to Jericho is fulfilled because it gets destroyed. Then Joshua made an oath, verse 26, "Cursed before the Lord is the man who rises up and builds the city Jericho. With the loss of his firstborn, he shall lay its foundation. With the loss of his youngest son, he shall set up its gates." This city has been dedicated to God for destruction, which means it's going to be destroyed. Now, there were settlements around Jericho and set up, and people built settlements. We're not talking about building settlements. We're talking about rebuilding the whole city and setting it up against God's character, as we can defy God and build the city. Raggy?
There's also a New Testament Jericho. The Jericho of the Old Testament, is an archaeological site. And somewhere between there and Jerusalem, there's another city named Jericho, which when referenced in the New Testament, it's that second location. Otherwise, one might think that in fact it had been
rebuilt. It hasn't, correct. And there's the promise to Joshua in verse 26. It's 27, "So the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame was in all the land." The Lord would give his people the first and strongest town or city of Canaan as the first fruits of the land without any effort on their part except marching around, believing what God said and acting on his battle plan. And that becomes a sign that God was going to give them the whole land if they would continue to act in faith and believe what God said and act on that. Because the conquest is not their work, it's God's work because it's based on his promise. One of the great lessons that come from this well-known story is that God is faithful to his word. He keeps his promises to the nation, to Rahab, to us. And he desires then that we be faithful to him. Because without faith, the writer to the Hebrews reminds us, it's impossible to please God. What God desires from us is faithfulness. I would suggest not perfection, but faithfulness, where we walk with him daily in all the circumstances of life. And our ability to be faithful will be deeply impacted by our clear conviction of his eternal faithfulness to us. What God starts, God finishes. And God has begun a good work in us, Philippians chapter 1 and verse 6. and he will bring it to completion. So when a big wave of life washes over your faith, return to Joshua 6 and see once again how faithful God is, that he can be trusted. Submit yourself to his authority, align yourself with who he is, worship him, and your faith will be safe and secure.